My name is Autumn Adkins Graves, and I am a member of the class of 1994 and will be your moderator here today. It's really an honor and very exciting to be able to be in this space with so many people who came before me as Wahoos, and also meeting some who future Wahoos and some others who graduated after me, who are all making really tremendous impacts in the world in one way or the other. We have a great panel here of women who truly are impactful and effective and well-regarded and well-known in their particular fields. And so it's exciting for us to have this opportunity to hear a little bit from you about your experience. I am an educator myself, and so I loved the topic of this panel, which is, you know, oftentimes as teachers, you're not quite sure how effective you really are with your students, because how many people here are teachers or in education? So you're constantly planting seeds, and you do not often see them grow or sprout, and you're not sure what's going on. Well, I think this panel, these panelists here today, are proof that there were some seeds that were planted that clearly took off and grew and have spread in really wonderful ways. And one of the things that we'll be talking about this afternoon is really, what did they learn? What was it that they got from their experience here that they've used to take themselves into these particular career paths in some cases, uncharted territories for women? So I'm going to ask each panelist to please introduce herself and just to give us your name, maybe a little bit about what you do, but also if you could tell us something about an experience or about a memory or moment in your time being here on grounds that was important to you, that helped to shape who you are. And it can be something that's funny. It does not have to be, I'll say this. Whenever I interview people for jobs and I ask them often, what is your favorite book? And if someone tells me War and Peace, I'm often like, yeah, I'm not working with you. So, you know, my favorite book is Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham. So please use this opportunity as one that is not, you know, it's not a Senate confirmation hearing. So I'd like to start with you, Barbara, to introduce yourself and tell us about something interesting about your experience here.
I will tell you, I did tell a joke at my Senate confirmation hearing. And my friend who was there after it was over said, I only gave you one bit of advice. Don't tell a joke at your Senate confirmation hearing. I'm Barbara Lynn. I'm in the famous class of 74. I'm a federal district judge in Dallas, Texas. And before that, I was a lawyer. And I attended law school in Dallas at Southern Methodist University. I will tell a story about the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society. You all have heard a few references to it. Unlike many of the other organizations of the university, where we just had to knock on the door, and although they didn't really want to open the door, they did open the door and we got to walk in. In the case of the Jefferson Society, the door was locked because the Jefferson Society had bylaws that prohibited the Jefferson Society from admitting women, and the university didn't require that that be changed. So it took a lot of persuasion and a year and a half to convince them to change, and I'll tell the story of the day it changed. I was dating my husband Mike, and I will spend just a second with an aside about him. When I came to the university, I had done the math that many of us did and figured there were 22 men to one of us, and that sounded kind of good. And they figured out that there was only one of us for 22 of them, so they kept rolling down the road, except for Mike. Mike figured that if he stayed here, there would be 22 of us for him. So it took a while for him to get to my dorm, but eventually he and I started dating, and we've been married 37 years. And Mike was the vice president of the Jefferson Society, so when he found out I was interested, because I was a high school debater, he brought me to the meetings, and I was able to participate in the meeting, although I couldn't join. They had to interview me because I showed up every semester, and many of you who know me know some of those stories about those interviews, which were really astonishing and gave me a lot of life skills. So the conservative members of the Jefferson Society went off to the Mardi Gras. And Mike was presiding as the vice president, and he did a head count. And he figured he had the votes for coeducation by one. And so they called for coeducation, and it passed by one vote. This is Mardi Gras 1972. And I'll just sum up by saying, when the guys came back from Mardi Gras, beads were flying.
I don't want to follow that. I'm Kathy Thornton. I'm an associate dean here in the engineering school now. Before that, I came here from NASA, where I was an astronaut for 12 years and flew four times on the space shuttle. I still can't tell a story like that. Well, I could, but I won't. You know, my defining moment was when I came here. I was here as a graduate student, not as an undergraduate, so my experiences are a lot different than many of you. But, you know, one of the things that's important to learn is that people in other cultures don't think the way we do. Everybody is different, and they have their own cultural norms. My sort of out-of-culture experience came from coming here from an SEC school and going to my first football game. And it was, I couldn't believe that you could walk into the football stadium with your student ID, whereas there we stood in line for lotteries for tickets. And then the basketball season came, and it was exactly the opposite. So this is where I learned that the people everywhere don't think and act the same way, that this was a much different place than where I had come from. And it's been a great place to be. But that's one of the big experiences. I try to relate that to undergraduates when I talk to them and encourage them to do a semester abroad or a summer abroad or something, because even when we go visit some of our countries that are our closest allies and friends, there's still a lot of difference in culture, probably even maybe less so than the SEC to the ACC, but something along those lines.
Thanks. First, it's an honor to be here with these wonderful women that I'm on the panel with. My name is Val Ackerman. I'm a proud graduate of the college, class of 1981. I was a political and social thought major. And I was a student athlete here, so I was very interested to hear some of the accounts earlier about the student athlete experience in the years before I got to UVA in the fall of 1977. I was very fortunate because by the time I got here, you know, women here was sort of old hat, I would say. At least that was the impression I had by the fall of 1977. And Title IX, which was passed in 72, was very much the catalyst for getting funding and resources behind athletics at both the high school and intercollegiate level, was really sort of taking hold. And we had a very enlightened athletic director when I came here, Gene Corrigan, who some of you may know personally or remember, who really did a great deal for women's sports here. But anyway, when I sort of came trooping down here in the fall of 77, I was coming down to play on the women's basketball team. I was in Debbie Ryan's first class in the fall of 77. And she is a legend and an icon here and has done an amazing job in her long career. But when I was here, the good news was there was a scholarship. There was scholarship money for women's basketball. The bad news is there was only one that was available to the entire team. And the good news was I got some of that money. The bad news is I didn't get all of it. Debbie, being ever resourceful, split the one scholarship among two players. So I shared the first scholarship for the women's basketball program. And here's how it worked. I got tuition and fees, and my teammate got room and board. So I got to go to class, and she got to eat. You know, so it was sort of like the sharing thing that we had going there. And I guess sort of, you know, I don't know what I learned from this, but sort of the defining experiences for me were just how, while, yeah, that was progress in many forms, the men's team at that time was really so much further ahead of us. I mean, while the football team was, you know, not what you'd see in the SEC at that time, to put it mildly, the men's basketball team was that and more. They were sort of Final Four material, sort of, you know, every road game they were jetting, they were on the jet. They had a locker room with a carpet. Our locker room didn't even have a carpet at U-Haul. And so I don't know what this story means, but for what it's worth, I'll tell it, because when I was asked to say the story, this was, for strange reasons, what came to mind. Not only did we not fly to the away games, but we took the vans. And sort of the hitch was the coaches drove the vans, the coaching staff. And there were two, Debbie and an assistant. There were only two coaches at that time. And I'm just going to tell you one thing. When you go down to Carolina and you lose by 30 points down there, you do not want to be coming back to Charlottesville in a van that's being driven by the head coach. And that's what happened to me in 1979. We got our butts whooped in Carolina by a lot. And Debbie was so upset with us, we weren't even allowed to take showers. We had to just load into the vans right after the game. We didn't even get to sort of, you know, mop up. I had played, you know, I played a lot, so I had logged a lot of minutes. And I got into the van, and we pulled an hour out of Chapel Hill, and a couple of players were in the van, and one of the other passengers was Debbie's cousin, Kevin Corrigan, Gene's son, who was a friend of the team, and he happened to be in my van. And lo and behold, about an hour into the trip, I developed the most terrible leg cramps. I mean, I hadn't showered. I was really sore. And I was afraid to say anything because, you know, Debbie was doing 90 miles an hour to get back to Charlottesville. So I really didn't want to have to say anything. But it got to me, and I sort of started making some requests from the back seat if we could maybe pull over so I could stretch out. So Debbie, you know, didn't want to, but she pulled the car over, and we're on the side of the road. I think we were not quite at the Virginia border yet, so we were deep in Carolina country at that point on some back road off, I guess we were on 29. And Kevin, trying to be helpful, was sort of massaging the backs of my legs as I was laying on the shoulder of the road. And lo and behold, a North Carolina state trooper pulled up. And there we were, this band of sort of women's basketball players in 1979, hadn't showered, looking, you know, not our best. In a van with me laying on the side of the road and this young gentleman massaging my calves. And we had to do some explaining as to what we were doing and why we were doing it and so forth. But we sort of talked our way through that and got back in the van and made it back to Charlottesville. Now, don't ask me why I told this story, but it's, I guess, sort of maybe a then and now story. That was then. And fortunately, that kind of thing doesn't have to happen anymore. But I think it really did speak volumes about sort of what we went through in our early years as student athletes here and clearly what's happened to this university in terms of the depth and the quality of its women's athletic programs and how seriously they're taking. I speaks volumes about the leadership here and certainly about the students and the administrators and everybody that's been involved in that march.
Hi, I'm Deanne Maynard, and I'm flattered to be on this panel. In fact, it's sort of like which one of these things is not like the other. I'm a lawyer in Washington, as lots of people are, and I graduated from the college in 1987, and I went from here after a year off. I went to Harvard Law School. Some of my classmates are quite famous; you've heard of them, and. One is the President of the United States, and I loved my time at UVA, and this isn't exactly an at UVA story, but my first job out of law school was a clerkship for Judge Stanley Harris, who on the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia, and he was a double who. And so the first question in my interview was, why didn't you go to UVA for law school? And I said, I'm in my second year at Harvard at the time, and I say, I've been asking myself that question for 2 years.
Good answer.
And I got the job.
You should have said you weren't smart enough to get admitted at UVA.
That would have flattered.
Well, clearly we have a panel with a great sense of humor, so I think this is going to be a really... fun time together. You know, they often talk about what it's like to come home. And I'd love to know, Catherine, from you, coming back to the University of Virginia after having a truly tremendous career in science and space, what drew you to come back here to the university to teach?
It was sort of a pragmatic decision. I was with NASA for 12 years, loved every minute of it. Would have stayed there for the rest of my career, except that I had three daughters who were growing up, and I wasn't home very much, and my husband was still living here in Charlottesville. We were in Houston. So after 12 years of that, it seemed like a reasonable thing to park our toothbrushes in the same house for more than just long weekends, and so that was sort of our decision to come here.
So it sounds like you have had an experience that I know many people have, which is trying to figure out that work-life balance. And it sounds like one of the ways that you tried to create that was to actually live in the same city, which I'm impressed by that.
That made life enormously easier in some ways, maybe less easier in others.
Yes, I'm sure it does. I would love to know from any of the other panelists, how have you created that work-life balance for yourselves? Do you have any wisdom or tips that you would like to share with us?
I have always said that I feel like I'm a pinball going through life, and when I'm about to fall through the hole at the bottom, someone whacks me up to the top of the game again. It's just too terrifying to contemplate too much, so I've tried not to. I remember one of my horror stories. I tried very hard to go to as many of my kids' activities as I could. I have two daughters. And so at the beginning of the school year, I would put every event that I knew about on my calendar. And they both went to a private girls' school, and they wore a uniform. So there was one day the whole year where they got to have the tea and wear fancy dresses, and the moms either baked or, of course, bought dessert. And so I had this all planned, and I had bought my dessert. My kids made me promise that I would buy my dessert. And so there had been a reminder notice for the event, and it said reminder notice. And I already had it on my calendar, so I didn't need reminding. And I showed up at 3:00, and there were a lot of people leaving. And I became concerned. And I went in there, and of course it was over because the reminder was a change of time as well as a reminder, and it had been moved from 3 to 2, and there was my daughter with the school counselor. And I said, when you're done with her, I would like some counseling also. And so most of the time it worked out fine. I mean, my husband's been a wonderful husband and a wonderful father, but, you know, we couldn't do it all the time. And the other thing I will comment on is that after a number of years in my law firm where there were a couple of us who became partners, a lot of other women arrived and said, we don't want to live that life, that crazy life you're leading. Where you're getting 5 hours of sleep every night and, you know, working at night and going to your kids' everything and being everything to everybody. And I said, that's fine by me. I'm not imposing my structure on anybody else. But it is naive to say that this is not hard. It was very hard. It remains hard. It's still hard. People commit crimes. They need to have their trials, even though I might want to be doing something else. Yes, I mean, yeah, really, people lie, cheat, and steal on their own schedule, and I may be on vacation. So it's really a question of just doing the best you can, and I tried not to be too hard on myself. I told my kids that sometimes I would be a C+ as a mother. I would try never to fall below a D. And I think I really stayed at C+ or above most of the time, and as a lawyer, I tried to stay at B-. And, most of the time, I was an A, but there were a couple of times I had to go to the senior partner and say, you might want to discount the bill, because I just couldn't do it very well on 1 hour sleep today. So, you know, I had a lot of supportive friends, and we all kind of worked it through together and had a supportive spouse and family.
It's great. I think it's an important lesson. We always tried to be perfect. We always were trying to make an A. And sometimes it's okay to just be a little bit above average as opposed to being exceptional at everything. It's a really important lesson to learn. Val, what are your
Well, I have two daughters. My oldest is 18. My youngest is 16. And, I look back on my sort of work life, and I think the hardest part of it was the balancing. I mean, some days the work part was the easiest part, and I'm looking around, a lot of people are shaking their heads. So I would say for all of you who've been through this, we get it here. I think there's no woman I've ever spoken with in this position who hasn't had to manage this. And for women out there who don't have kids yet or think they might like to, I have to just tell you, warn you, it's really hard. There's no magic bullet. I mean, we all come to rely on our support networks, our own personal energy levels. I mean, I would do to-do lists in the middle of the night because that's the only time I had to do the list. I had travel on top of the work, and that makes it harder. My husband, who recently retired, was a partner in a Wall Street law firm. So the good news was he didn't have to travel. The bad news was he had long hours at the end of the day. New York is sort of a late start, late finish law firm environment. So we had to rely on the nanny, and it was really hard. And like Catherine, I mean, I put in about 12 years of that, and I just sort of, I died, figuratively. I mean, it was just a lot, and I didn't want to sort of wake up one day and wish and wonder what it would have been like if I'd been home a little more with my daughter. So I made a change now 6 years ago. I've been fortunate that I've been able to do other things that are more on my schedule. I could do some things from home. I sort of used to believe that quality time was all that mattered, and I don't think it is. It's quantity too. And that's it's a hard truth when you're trying to work your way professionally. So whenever I get asked questions by people, at least in my business and sports, young women trying to get in, I mean, I just tell them, you need to be a really good time manager if you want to be a parent. You just have to be. And you have to be prepared to make sacrifices. I mean, you just have to know that if you want to advance professionally, you have to, especially in sports where you have to show up at stuff. You can't sort of conference call into the All-Star game. I mean, you got to like sit there and watch it in the flesh. So you have to make those sacrifices, and I do think you can do everything for a little while, is sort of my mantra. But after a while, you sort of things catch up. So it's a tough one.
Yeah, I wish I had all the answers. In fact, I'm balancing right now. My girls are right over there with Alex. So I have a six-year-old, almost six-year-old, and a nine-year-old, and sort of really busy professionally at the moment, so it's why I don't have the answers. I don't think there is any right answer. It depends. I have a great husband who gets home every night and makes them dinner, and I try to make it home by dessert, and so that's huge. And I have lots of support, and there's lots of other parents at their school, women who have chosen a different path, who pitch in and help me out, will send me emails saying, if you can't make it, I will get your girls and take them, they can come with us, and that kind of thing, which is just, it's a godsend. But I try to think that there's upsides for them too. Carrie, when I first got my job in the Justice Department and was arguing fairly often in the Supreme Court, she was like, I really want to come see you argue in the Supreme Court. Well, she was four at the time, and I thought that was a little young, even for someone who was really interested in it. So I said, well, when you're seven. Okay. So sure enough, seventh birthday. I'm seven, and I want to come see you argue in the Supreme Court. And so, of course, now I was thinking seven seems kind of young, too. But a promise is a promise. So Carrie came and watched me argue a tax case in the Supreme Court. And some Supreme Court cases are boring, and tax cases are really, really boring. Carrie, she enjoyed it. Her comments afterwards included, Mommy, they were a little mean to you. So I didn't win that one. I said, no, that's their job. My job is to stand there and try to answer their questions. And her other question was, how do they keep those big cement flowers from falling off the ceiling? And I don't know if you've ever seen the Supreme Court ceiling, but it's beautiful and has these. And so now every time I go in there, I think, how do they keep those big cement flowers from falling off the ceiling?
I'd like to add one more thing. My girls are now grown, and they spent, you know, 12 years with just me as a parent, their father here in Charlottesville, and they had to be pretty independent. It was hard on me, but it was also hard on them. But I'm happy to say they're all in their 20s now, and they have grown up to be wonderfully confident and competent young women, maybe in part because they had to during all those years. So there's hope on the end of this.
I have a lot of questions, but I want to give opportunity for those of you who are in the audience who may have some questions as well. And I'm going to borrow this mic, I think. I'll start here and then I'll come back to you.
Hi, I was just wondering if you have, I don't know that any of you have done this, but I have a 15-year-old and an 8-year-old who I interrupted my career to stay home with, and I've been a teacher before that, and I've been back in and back out as, you know, as I needed to be to be home with them, and I'm finding it really, really hard to re-enter the workforce, and I'm wondering if you have any tips for someone who's been kind of out of it and a little bit in, and, you know, stuck my foot back in, so took it back out, but feel like the world has passed me by in the meantime, and I'm just, you know, trying really hard for a long time now to re-enter the workforce, and I feel like my kids are at an age where I can do it, but it's not, you know, the jobs are not coming where I'm looking. So does anybody have any tips for what to kind of create my own opportunity or whether to, you know, what to do? Thanks.
Hi, does this work?
No.
No. Maybe.
That one has.
Okay. I think you have to keep up your network, for one. I mean, if there's a field that you're interested in re-entering or if it's something new, you have to just sort of do the hard, be out there stuff. Refer back to your contacts before you left your old job, perhaps, because I do think the more you keep up with old names and new names and that people know that you're still out there and not sort of gone, that can help as opportunities emerge. I mean, things change all the time, and something that might not have been an opportunity 5 years ago might be today, or 3 months ago might be tomorrow. So I think that's a part of it. I do think keeping your skill sets fresh, whether you're working or not working, is critical. I mean, I was sort of laughing at the comment, might have been, I can't remember who made it, about the digital divide and sort of this, look, all of us are, you know, we're living in a different world. My 16-year-old sleeps with her cell phone next to her pillow. I've sort of abdicated in a way on that, because I've come to accept that's how that generation is communicating. That's how they function. It's about Facebook, and it's about texting, and it's about this mastery of technology that it's just unimaginable. I bought a cell phone, and while I was pulling out the manual to figure out how to put my outgoing greeting in, I was like, you know, congratulations, you've just bought. My 15-year-old had already programmed my phone completely. She just took it out of the box and just everything was done. So by the time I got to the phone, I didn't have to do anything anymore. I mean, it was sort of amazing and frightening all at once. Because what my point is we're playing in that world too. So, you know, we have to keep up. So whether it's in technology or whether it's in other technical skills or, I mean, gosh, my biggest regret is I don't have more language ability. I serve on the as the U.S. representative to the International Basketball Federation Board, which is in Switzerland. There's very few women on the board. I'm one. They all speak 100 languages, and I speak English. And the good news is everyone speaks English. But the bad news, at least for me, is that I can't converse with people in their language, which I do think is critical in terms of establishing relationships and sort of getting close to people. So things like language skills and technology skills and just sort of other skills that sort of keep you fresh and marketable and saleable, I think, while you're waiting for that opportunity to hit and as you're doing your networking, you have to sort of be able to keep up so that when the opportunity hits, you can demonstrate that you haven't been left behind.
I think also sometimes women lose sight of the value of volunteer work, and how do you frame that and package that just not only in your resume, but then also when you are in this in-between stage waiting to go out and perhaps experiment or try to become an intern. Interns don't have to be 18. And that's the way that oftentimes you can get some of those technical experiences and just getting back into it in a new way. And I think more and more employers are becoming aware that they need to look at women's volunteer experience, but they also, it's up to the woman to package themselves. And so often it's about packaging. And you're sitting next to a packager. This is what she does for a living. Exactly. So she'll package you. It's all going to be good. I love it. There was someone up here. No? Okay.
One big workshop that they do is changing careers for those who are doing family job sequencing, or potentially because of the economic crisis or other, or just technology changes, changing careers completely. So there's a whole workshop available to you there for, it's a bargain. And they'll help you put your resume together, and in putting your resume together, if they see there are certain gaps, they'll advise you on how to, fill it up. And
have any of you ever been afraid? You're fearful that maybe you're not as prepared as perhaps the other people are who you're with. And I'd be curious to know how one of the things that I hear so often is that, generally speaking, men never think that they're unprepared. But women always think they're unprepared. And so I'd love just to get a sense of, you all have done just extraordinary things in your careers. And you've been in very male-dominated worlds. Have you ever been afraid or felt unprepared? And how did you get past that to kind of push into that fear place in a positive way?
I never felt fear of being unprepared because I was never unprepared. I just made myself prepared all the time. And now I'd say about 95% of the time I'm prepared. And when I'm not prepared, I'm not afraid to say it. So if I show up for a hearing and I'm not quite ready because of whatever, I'll tell the lawyers that. But they know that if I don't say that, they better be prepared because I'm prepared. I just was raised that way, and it made life harder because I probably could have gotten by running at 85% instead of 100% all the time. But, Jewish guilt goes a long way, and my parents laid it on me pretty thick, so I was always prepared.
Let me speak from the other end of the bell curve. I applied to be an astronaut. I had no idea what I was doing. Absolutely none. I mean, there was like a chance in a billion, so why not? It's sort of, the best thing you can hope for, but it'll never happen. And so lo and behold, I was selected, and I'll never believe anything other than they called the wrong number. And not to admit that NASA ever made a mistake, we continued with that. I got down there, and, typically half to two-thirds of the class were military, mostly test pilots, and they're in a very small community and all know each other and all know the guys who went ahead of them and know everything. And then there were two or three civilians who had worked for NASA, and then me. And I, honest to goodness, didn't know which end of the shuttle was up. But, I kept my mouth closed and my eyes open, and I listened and I learned, and eventually caught up with the rest of them. But it was scary at first because I lived in fear that somebody would ask me a question that I would answer incredibly stupidly. And so I guess they thought that I was very quiet instead of just stupid, which is not a bad strategy, I suppose.
I'm sort of in Barbara's camp. I mean, you know, I thought I was smart enough for most things, but I always encountered people that I felt were a lot smarter than I was. And so for me, the way to cope with that was to be as prepared as I could be. And so I to the point of sometimes being over-prepared. So whether it was in a meeting, whether it was, you know, before a boss, I worked actually, my principal boss over the years was a very demanding person. I worked for David Stearns, commissioner of the NBA. He's amazingly smart. It's like arguing in front of the Supreme Court with him. You get in there and 30 seconds later you're being cut off and asked the question that you thought he was going to ask you an hour later. So, you know, you have to react. And so for me, preparation is key. And I really don't think, I tell my daughters this, I don't really think some people really are smart enough to not be prepared and capable enough in other ways, quick on their feet or so forth. But I really do think that, being successful really is driven by making the sacrifices, doing the work, doing the preparation, whether you're a professional, whether you're a student, maybe even as a parent. There's things you can do to sort of plan for, can't plan for everything, but you do your best. So I'm kind of with Barbara. I'd be too scared to be unprepared.
I think I spent half my life preparing or more, and I'm on the other end of the judge's questions, hoping that I'm more prepared or at least as prepared as the judge asked me the questions. So, but I also learned the best answer when you don't know is, I don't know. So I have uttered that, and you know, the first time I had to say that, I felt really bad, but now I've decided the best strategy is, the best thing to do in that situation is say, I don't know, and then as fast as you can say, but I do know this, and segue to something that seems as close to what they're asking as you can, that you do know. So because you can't know everything that a judge is going to ask you, and you can't, as hard as many questions as you think of, and the hundreds of questions that you think of, and you have answers to, you know, there is one, like with the Supreme Court, there are 9 of them, and they all have 4 law clerks, and they're pretty smart people. And, you know, you could get asked something you don't know, and it happens. So the best, and it's happened. So, but I think in some ways it's more, you know, you get as prepared as you can, and then you learn how to cope with the reality of not knowing something.
One of the things that I experience in my career, I work in education, and so I value integrity greatly, and we teach it a lot. And having gone to the University of Virginia and also a prep school in Richmond, that idea of honor was always forefront in the conversations about the type of person that I was to be or I could be. And I'd love just to get a sense from you all, the role that honor or the role that having gone to a school, to a university that has a strong sense of honor and an honor code, how has that impacted or affected your career or some of the decisions that you make or how you mentor people in your fields? And I'll start with you. We're going to mix it up. Can't always be in a row.
Well, picking up from my last comment, I think what you see when you work with people who didn't come here and who didn't grow up in the system of honor is where you notice it the most. And, you know, what I find most aggravating, and I try to teach the people that I'm mentoring to do, is if you don't know something, the best thing to tell me is you don't know. But so many people think that's the wrong answer, and they'll bluff. You know, they'll bluff, even though, and then when they bluff, I mean, how stupid do they think I am? You know, it's something, just because I ask you a question doesn't mean I don't know the answer. Hey. And or I don't know enough to know that what you're about to tell me is not right, you know. And so I think that it's having come here and having that ingrained in you that, what you say, is true, that what you've done is your work, those are really important lessons, and I think it serves the students who come from here really well, and people who haven't had that ingrained in them, it's a very good career skill to have. And I think that, I do try to teach the people. The best thing you can tell me is the truth, even if you're fessing up to something you didn't do, I ask you to do, or you don't know, and if they don't, they learn the hard way that doesn't win you any points with me.
It's also a great lesson for your daughters to learn.
Oh, they know.
I'll just make one comment, and it's sort of a recent example here, which I think harkening back to my technology comment. At the school where my youngest daughter goes, high school in New York City, they're really dealing very seriously with the issue of plagiarism. I mean, with technology has come the ability to sort of Google any subject for any report and just sort of lift wholesale paragraphs off the internet and just sort of paste them onto your Word document, and you all of a sudden, voila, you have a paper. So the old, the old things we did about researching and...
You had to read it first.
We had to read it, right. You had to sort of go to the library and go to the card catalog. I mean, forget it. Just Google everything. So it's sort of interesting, and this just came up last week around my dinner table. So, I do think that, I got to confess, I don't wake up every morning thinking honor code. It's sort of the principles I think are diffused into all of us, and at least that's a sort of modest example about how, in this day and age anyway, how to communicate these principles of honesty and integrity and sort of originality, particularly when we're dealing with whether they be students or our own kids, really matters. I would just say, in my business, there's not a lot of turnover. I mean, people come to work in sports. They tend to stay for life, and it's less that than it used to be. But the point is, it's a small world, so you're just dealing with the same people over and over again, some cases for a period of years. And, your word is everything. And probably a lot of businesses are like that. I mean, you have to be a person of integrity who speaks the truth and who people can trust. And if you're not, you're not going to make it in the business, because the business is so built on personal relationships. Probably, again, a lot of businesses are that way. So while I don't think the honor code is sort of, it's sort of a couple of steps from that principle, the whole notion of what the honor code meant in terms of integrity and honesty, I do think applies certainly in the professional world, and certainly where in contexts where, your word and your credibility and your reliability as a colleague, as a boss, as an employee really matter. I think those things really do affect all of us every day.
Barbara, I have a question for you. Others will have an opportunity to answer this as well. Who had the biggest impact on you while you were a student at UVA, and what did he or she teach you?
Well, I'm going to exclude my husband, because I have to say, as I reflect back now, it would be him, because we did so much together, and I ended up coming to Texas because of him, so he's really had the biggest impact on me. But I don't think you mean that, so I'll confine myself to people who worked at the university. I think that the professors in the history department, I was a history major, and Ken Elzinga probably were the people that influenced me the most. I just love the history department. I mean, it was the most remarkable group of people, and I can't really single out Willie Lee Rose from Paul Gaston. I mean, everybody was just phenomenal. And, I mean, Janet was talking about being 18. I was 17. When I came here, and I had never even been away from home. My parents, I remember dropping me off at Watson and driving away, and I'm like, I didn't really mean it. Come back and get me. Oh my God, what am I doing here? And I don't even know anybody here. Virginia, what was I thinking? So I just really had to grow up really fast, and I didn't know anybody here. I'd never set foot on the place. I didn't even know it wasn't co-ed when I applied. So it was, I found that out because one of my friend's dad said, you can't go there. And I said, really? They took my deposit. That I know it makes me seem foolish, but it is what it is. That's when I found out that the university had not been co-educated fully before 1970. So it was all a big new world to me, and I showed up here naive, not knowing anything, not knowing anybody, and I just sucked it up like a sponge. And I didn't have as much contact with administration as many of my classmates from 74 did, and part of that was that I was so involved with the Jefferson Society, and they weren't, and I'm not being critical when I say this, it was a conscious choice, but they weren't being particularly helpful about that. So I really didn't have much to do with the administration in the Jefferson Society. So I really just went into the history department with both feet, and I could list 10 professors in the history department who really had a tremendous impact on me.
What did they teach you? Like, what was it about, well, in addition to the love of history?
I would say that what I learned here that really made a tremendous difference in my career path is not letting anybody tell me that I couldn't do something. Because, you know, when barriers large and small were set up for all of us, we either went around or through. And most of them we went around for the Jeff Society had to go through. I would have preferred to go around. But and the professors, my experience was I probably had some experiences where I got that look that was referred to, but I really don't remember that. If that happened to me, it didn't sink in. I felt that the professors were very supportive, taught me to stand up for myself. I didn't have Lynn's problem with them not knowing that I was a woman on the class roster. They obviously knew that. And I felt that they called on me. They pushed me to do my best work. They pushed me to take the responsibility that I was capable of shouldering. And they taught me not to take no for an answer. And I guess if you don't mind, I'll fast forward since I have the mic. That issue of not taking no for an answer was a critical aspect of my life because I went to law school. I was married. I did very well in law school, and we formed an association of women law students because there weren't very many of us in law school at that time. And in my class of the top 10 women, we were 15% of the law school class, but we were 50% of the top 10 in my class in law school. And so we thought, well, we're just shoo-ins for the great jobs in Dallas. But we were wrong. And we started interviewing, and we got questions like, what's your husband going to do when you don't have dinner ready at 6 o'clock? And what are you going to do with your children? And you know, I wanted to say, you got to be kidding me. But that wasn't, you don't say that in Dallas. It's got its own language, too. So eventually, we sued the Dallas law firms, several of us. And that wasn't welcomed in the legal community. We weren't met with a round of applause. And, but I remembered very well, don't take no for an answer, and try to go around, but if you can't go around, go through. And those were difficult times, and I'll just punctuate it with one story that I think will say something about my law firm and one of my mentors. So I was very fortunate because I lucked into a job with the law firm I eventually went to work for as a first-year student during the summer. It was a fabulous law firm. And I wanted to go to work there. I didn't compromise. I wanted to go to work there, and I did. And I was subpoenaed to testify as a witness in one of the cases that went to trial. And I hadn't made a big deal with my law firm about the fact that the lawsuit was pending and that I was a witness. But the senior partner in my law firm, Jim Coleman of Carrington Coleman, came to see me, and he said, I heard you're testifying in the case. Would you like me to go with you to your testimony? And I said, well, duh. Of course, Jim, that would be wonderful. I wouldn't have thought to bother you, but I'd love for you to come. So he walked me to the courthouse. He walked with me into the courtroom. Before he sat down with me in the front row, he made it a point to go over to the defense table and say hello to all the guys over there and make sure he knew he was over there with me, his lawyer, one of his lawyers. And that really made it all worthwhile. I mean, it said to me what I learned when I was in college, that against wrong and wrongdoing and evil, there are good people, men and women, who will stand side by side with you and support you. And I had that all along, and it gave me courage and comfort, and those were lessons I learned here.
Yeah. It's interesting, Barbara, you talk about, I guess, in the mid-70s, that people, when you were interviewing, asked questions about what will your husband do? There's not dinner on the table. I actually was interviewing for a head of school's job at a private school in Philadelphia in 2007, and the same question was asked of me.
Well, I wanted to say my husband's response to that was, do not make me dinner. But I didn't.
But it says, I mean, I think that we're in a world where we still haven't, I guess, progressed as much as folks think. And there are those traditional gender roles that some people are really still caught up in and feel compelled to speak to in an interview.
I hear the stories from my law clerk candidates that judges ask those questions. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely. Any other questions from folks out here?
How do you, you don't need that.
Okay.
How do you translate your perfectionism and your work ethic with your kids? Because kids are not always perfect. Maybe you were lucky and you got the perfect ones. How did you deal with that issue? I think it's been a problem for me, so I'll say it that way, that my high expectations for my kids or
well, I'll start. I'll be brief with it. I did not impose those standards on my children. I think I've been pretty good about it, but they got it from someplace because both of my girls were very hard-driving in different ways. I've got one doctor and one getting a master's in art history, but they came to it differently. My younger daughter recently said, I'm just like you. I'm acting like you. And I said, well, I had that epiphany with my mother, too. But, I mean, I think that children who are raised by hard-driving parents have problems with that, and you have to be adaptable and be kind and let them make their own way. And I tried that. I don't judge myself any more harshly on that than anything else.
Well, I am so far from being perfect that that was not an issue in my household. I'm a role model for screw up and recover, which we all do. Everybody makes mistakes, and you own up to them, and you do what you can to rectify them, and you move on from there. But, you know, my goal for my girls, and we were talking, we all have girls, all of us, is to be happy. And whether it's to be happy being a hard-charging, you know, if that's the way you choose to live your life, that's who you are. If it's not who they are, then I let them be who they are. And they've all turned out pretty well, in spite of me.
Uh-oh. You're a work in progress.
I'm still working on it. I don't know. Carrie's plan, she's 9. Her plan is that she, I'll start with Madison. Madison's 5. She's about to be 6. And her plan is that she is going to stay at home, look after her kids, so that her nanny can stay at home, look after her kids. And Carrie's plan is that she's going to live around the corner from Charlie and me so that I can look after her kids while she goes to work. And there are logical flaws in both of these plans, but I'm going to let them figure them out. And on my good days, I try to be, you know, I have days of like both of those. Sometimes I get Jekyll and Hyde mom. They go to this wonderful school that encourages the kids to be all about whoever they are. And someone said it earlier today, I think it was Alex in her speech, said something about, that's Madison waving at me, said about everyone, each of us is special and in a certain way and privileged and special. And so, you know, that's what I hope for them. Carrie once asked me, you know, what do you want, what should I be when I grow up? And I said, you should try to find something that you really like to do that people will pay you money for.
I think that is great advice for everyone. You should probably speak to a lot of undergraduates, too. A lot of parents would appreciate that. Well, I want to thank you all so much for your honesty and your candor and your exposure and also just the great sense of humor that you bring to life. And at the end of the day, it's important to be happy. And each of you has shown that in different ways, that it's about being happy. So I want to thank you all very much. And thank you all for being great audience members and participants. Yes.